Good morning. Can everyone hear me clearly? Good. I'm enjoying being here with you very much. And I hope you're enjoying your days here. I learned years ago from a friend in the State Department that when you travel, you get to a new place pretty far away, in a day or two you can fake it. But to actually settle in so that your sleep patterns and your eating patterns are where you are, it takes one day for every time zone. And so last night was my first full night's sleep. I'm right on on time. It's been about a week since, a little over a week since we've been in Israel. There were a couple of interesting questions that came through the bell. Let me start with those. One is about gata practice. There's a hand out there with a number of gatas. And it was about not wanting to become dependent on them. 2 days ago when we talked, when I talked, I mentioned that Thay teaches there are three basic ways to meditate. I mean, one is, I call the direct method, just being present to whatever is going on right now in us and around us. And the second was, he called, that first one he called sorting the mail. And the second one he called reading the mail. I think of it as widening our view. And so the gatas fall into that category. They're reminders both of where we are right now and what is our aspiration. How do we connect what we're doing right now with our aspiration to be fully present and to move into the ultimate dimension, to move into that place of no coming, no going, no same, no different. So we take a gata, like one of my favorites, washing the dishes gata. And it starts off, washing the dishes. I mean, it's a reminder, that's what I'm doing now, washing the dishes. And then it sort of points me into how to use this moment to not only to wash the dishes, but to be fully present and open myself wider. So the next line is, washing the dishes is like washing a baby Buddha. So that's sort of, how am I going to do this, this washing of the dishes? And it's with great care and attention. This is something precious. Like a baby Buddha, this dish, this cup. And as I take care of it, I breathe in and out. And then the next part of the gata is, the profane is the sacred, everyday mind is Buddha mind. And it's just this moment that there's not two worlds. There's not heaven and earth. I mean, heaven and earth are different ways of seeing this one reality. There's not the ultimate dimension and the historical dimensions as if we were going to practice for many years and we'll pop into the ultimate dimension. It's just always present. It's just another way. And my experience is we do it by glimpses. I mean, it's not that we pop into it and everything's changed, but we sort of catch ourselves, I mean, noticing that we're in this larger world. Another gata is one we can use for meditation or walking meditation. I have arrived, I am home. And so when we step or when we breathe, just to say, this is home. This is a place that's comfortable for me. This is a place where I'm known, where I know people, where I know things. I have arrived, I am home. In the here and in the now. Sometimes he says, that's your zip code, that's your postal address. is in the here and in the now. People want to get in touch with you. They do it in the here and in the now. I have arrived, I am home, in the here and in the now. I am solid, I am free, in the ultimate I dwell. And so again, it's this aspiration. And it's just pointing us. And usually we say the gatha and then continue with what we're doing, washing the dishes, walking, breathing. And we don't have to keep saying the mantra. It's not the gatha. It's not a mantra. A mantra in the Hindu tradition is magical words and sounds. If we say them enough, we're connecting with the gods and they hear us. And gathas are not like that. They're not magical words. They're just signposts. They're the finger pointing to the moon. They're not the moon. Over the years, bits and pieces, I've had some contacts with Thich Nhat Hanh, and I'm just so impressed of how he's always practicing. And these three methods, or the third method to go back, is Thich Nhat Hanh, to use the mail metaphors, when you're getting an express letter, somebody's on your doorbell, and you stop what you're doing and you go to get it. And I think of it as an emotional or spiritual emergency, that sometimes there's something so pronounced going on. Upset, anger, sadness, excited, anxiety, inexplicable joy, that you turn to it, that you no longer can just sort the mail. You can't read the letter because there's so much going on. So you turn to it and you lean into it and just embrace it. So but Thay is always practicing. And there's this one moment that really stays with me. I was with him in China in 98 maybe, with me and 180 of his closest friends. And we were on this tour and visiting various Zen monasteries, and he was giving talks. And we were in Nanking and getting off the plane, and I was a bit groggy and whatever. And I was sort of walking slowly, and I noticed that Thich Nhat Hanh was behind me. And so, as customary in the Vietnamese tradition, you honor your teacher. So I stood back and made a gassho, and as he was passing me, right in 15 feet in front of me was the escalator. So as he came by me, he grabbed my arm and pulled me along. So there I am going down the escalator with him. And he's going, woo! And we get off and we start walking towards the place where the luggage is coming. It's this big terminal in Nanking that's totally empty except for us. And there's just one sort of place to get your baggage. And I started telling him how wonderful this time was in China with him. And he looks over to me and says, present moment, wonderful moment. Which, present moment, wonderful moment. Which I interpreted as enough talking, Mitchell, just be quiet, be present. So I did. So we're walking along and I'm enjoying the steps and whatnot. And we get to about 30 feet from where the luggage will eventually come out, but there isn't any luggage yet. And there are there are a lot of monastics with us, like the 30 monastics, 40 monastics, and the lay people are all chatting. And so I bowed a tie, and then I noticed instead of going over to be with everyone else, he heads off in the other direction, doing slow walking meditation. And a bell went off and said, okay, I get it. I have a choice between going over there and chatting with everybody or taking this moment to ground myself. So he went that way and I went this way. And I started doing walking meditation around this big hall and just really enjoying it. His present moment, wonderful moment, was a bell of mindfulness for me. And it was quite pleasant, and it took a while to get. And it just happened that at the total other end of the hall, we passed each other, or we stopped, and we bowed to each other and talked for a few minutes. And he mentioned, this is interesting, if you've been at Plum Village, and you see Thai writing in Chinese. The interesting thing is, he doesn't speak a word of Chinese. That Chinese is an ideographic language, and wherever it went, they translated the ideogram for dog or light or mind or whatever into the local language. So what he had learned was Sino-Vietnamese. They had all the ideograms, but they had Chinese, they had Vietnamese words rather than Mandarin or whatever. The same happened in Korea or Japan or wherever the Chinese language went in those days. So he was very pleased. He could read the signs in the airport. I mean, because that he couldn't speak a word, but if you wrote it down in Chinese to him, he could read it. It's that odd thing about Chinese. So he was pleased with that. And then we both continued walking and came back. And so the practice is not one way of doing this, that you get right and that's all you do, whether it's the direct method or the gathas or the emergency or walking meditation or whatever. And they're not in contradiction. It's learning how to use all of them. And I mentioned the other day, he had this line from a talk in the 90s about the art of healing. And he talks about how he, uses some practices for a while and then stops using them. And that's what we should do. I mean, he says, I only do the practices that help me to rest, to heal, and to liberate myself. So that, there's a time when we may have a favorite practice, or and there's a time when that's lost its energy for us, and we move on to a new practice, or we understand things in a new way. I've several people told me the whole thing about Vedana went, for a lot of people, too complicated, too much, too long a journey. It's going to be much simpler today. But I was excited about it, because that for me was a new edge. I'll talk about that in a minute, but that whole notion of how the Buddha 2,500 years ago was working with something that today is just coming to the forefront in psychology about embodied feelings. Anyway, so we're our own guides in this, that it's another long story, but I'll make it short. Years ago, in the early 90s, I was happy. Plum Village was much simpler and, what's the word? Less planned, more spontaneous than it is now. There's a word that I use that might be a little bit harsh, which is wacky, meaning unplanned, spontaneous. Sometimes you don't know what you're doing, why they're doing it. And it's sometimes hard to distinguish insensitivity from greater wisdom, in terms of what happens. And so I was having some questionings about Plum Village and this whole tradition and whatnot. Because of these somewhat things were happening, and it revolved, the lower hamlet was all upset because some people had been asked to leave, and people weren't in agreement, it wasn't explained, etc., etc. And so there's a lot of commotion around that. And Thich Nhat Hanh gave this, so he gave a talk, and then in those days, guess I am telling another story. In those days, we would go for walking meditation, and then he would lead the 10 mindful movements, and then we would go back for lunch. So I went with them, and a lot of people stayed behind, and there were about 70 of us on the walk. It was a smaller community then. And then we did the mindful movements, and there are about 35 of us. And then people started to go back and tie, start like this, come here, come here. So we did. And then he said, come here, come here. And we did, a little bit closer, come here. So we're standing like, I'm about as close to Ty as Sheila is to me. And we had 35 people around. And he starts teaching walking meditation, as he often does. I've arrived, I am home, place a step. And he said, it's 100%, you've got to put 100%, really, and then 100%. And if you can do one step, then you can do two steps. And you really have to have courage to just really allow yourself to do this. And then he talked about how, whether you're from Washington, D.C., looking at me, or from India, and there was a nun from India standing next to me, a Catholic nun. The present moment is your true home. And then he started talking about how important it is to have a community. But the community is human, and the community will often let you down. And they talked about how important it is to have a teacher, but that the teacher, the human teacher you have, is human. And the teacher may let you down, but the present moment is your true teacher. The present moment will never let you down. And it just went through me. I mean, in an instant, all my doubts disappeared. I mean, I still had my doubts, but they weren't all collected together. I mean, doubts about I didn't understand what was going on. But Ty had just said, don't expect me to be perfect. Don't expect this place to be perfect. And when I thought about it later, I mean, they were all refugees in their own way, suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, there had been a lot of stress on all of them. And so it was really beautiful. The present moment is your true teacher. So back to the whole thing with Gatas. I mean, that's, in his wisdom, Ty keeps teaching us, is don't look to the books. Don't even look to him. Be inspired by him. But your real place that you're going to learn from is the present moment. And each of us has to figure out how to do that in our own way. Years ago, Gary Snyder had a line in an article. How did it go? Something like, the spiritual path is a path that cannot be followed. All right? And the idea was, really, I mean, as we follow the spiritual path, we can't imitate anyone else. We can't be like anyone else. We're our own unique creation, and we find our own way through it. And what works for me wonderfully today may not work for Rahel. And we come from different backgrounds. We have different embodied feelings. We have different responses. We have different genetics. How about a Belgian? So we come back to the present moment. Another interesting question I had was from somebody who basically said, well, this isn't really working. I try to sit, and I'm sleepy, and I spend my time daydreaming. What can I do? And I know that one. I've been there. And for me, the answer, well, there's lots of answers, but one answer is just about being sleepy, that we find in the U.S., and probably true in Israel, there's a huge percentage of the population that is sleep deprived, that we really don't get enough sleep. And so you come to a retreat and you say, okay, relax, come back to the present moment. And they're so, you know, they keep moving by being distracted by caffeine, by all sorts of things. And when they calm down, the experience they feel is how exhausted they are. And it often takes several days to get past that. They really need to rest. They need to sleep more. I mean, their body wants to sleep, and it's telling them. So that's one possibility, right? Get more sleep. Sleep is important. Get good sleep. The other thing is, was true for me, is that some of us have learned to live sort of from our neck up. I mean, we live so much in our heads, and we're always thinking about things. And especially today, we're constantly entertained. I mean, we live at a time when we have unimaginably more distractions available to us at every moment than anybody has ever had in history, right? I mean, the King of France in the 18th century, I mean, could, if he planned ahead, could ask the orchestra to come, or could ask the, you know, a dance troupe to come or something, or a musician. But he didn't have, you know, 3,000 songs on his iPod, or, you know, have the internet to just sort of allow him to, oh, let's see, you know, I wonder where broccoli came from. And then you could look it up and you find out, you know, that broccoli originated in the 15th century in Italy. You know, that, so anyway, we're used to that. And we're not used to quiet. We're not used to the subtleness of what's going on. And so for many of us, what happens, we're told to be quiet, told to be, follow our breath, and we're not getting much information, which is too subtle for us. So it's boring. So our mind wanders, right? And there's an interesting book called The Posture of Meditation, which talks about a good sitting posture, whether it's on a chair or on a cushion, is really about opening up to the body and allowing the body to speak to us in a louder voice. And with that louder voice, when we're really getting information from the body, we're awake and we're not distracted. We're not daydreaming because there's information coming in. So the book is by a guy named Will Johnson, who's a Rolfer, you know, about a deep massage therapist and teacher of meditation. He has both skills, so he really focused on this. And what he says, real briefly, is that there are three parts to good posture. One is alignment, that we have a natural alignment. And he, you know, here's a picture. Your ear, your shoulder, and your hip are basically in a line when you're either on a cushion or a chair. And the other part is, so once you get that alignment, then it's relaxation, allowing all the contractions in the body to just relax. As we talked about, it's like allowing the energy to flow. And the third part is resilience, that even as we breathe, we're alive, we're not stones, and there's these gentle movements we work with. And so we have to learn how to open up our body so there's more information. And that leads into a third question, which is somebody asked to really teach walking meditation. And because walking meditation is much about the same thing. So undo your feet for a minute and massage your legs if they're asleep. And we're all going to do a little bit of walking meditation, or in this context, the way we're set up, I call it mindful mingling. So, ready? Everybody ready to stand up? So let's stand up. So the question, you know, the art is, how do we make our bodies become more alive to this practice of walking meditation? And that's also the answer to that question of sleepiness. And when we begin, walking meditation may be much more fruitful than sitting meditation, because we're getting more information from the body as we're walking. And so it may be, you know, when you're at home, rather than doing sitting meditation, to do walking meditation for 20 minutes. You know, in any, you can go back and forth in your living room really easily, just to set off. Let me teach a little bit of it. So close your eyes, and I know you're already breathing, so then become aware of the breath. Breathing in, I'm aware of breathing in. Breathing out, I'm aware of breathing out. And then we let go of the words, or just say in, out, and just the physicality of breathing. And then still with our eyes closed, open up to our body. Breathing in, I'm aware of my body. Breathing out, I'm aware of my body. And we can notice our feet on the ground especially. Notice how they're holding us up and we're balanced on them. Notice this floor supporting me. Notice where your body is calling to you, the knees that may still be stiff, the shoulders that are feeling tight. Notice that our body is talking to us in a new way. So move your feet or hip width apart so you're not too close. And now, as you breathe in, shift all your weight to your left foot. And as you breathe out, shift it back to your right foot. And feel, and keep doing it, breathing in to the left foot, breathing out to the right foot. And feel this, the weightiness moving across your body, moving across your midline. That energy just moving through you. And it's usually calming. People who do work with trauma survivors really like this, because it's moving the energy across the midline. It's like a hug, like cradling ourselves. But just notice the information you're getting. Your body's speaking to you, it's alive. You are alive. So now open your eyes. Turn in a direction where you could take at least a few steps. Because normally we'd be nice, neat lines, but we're just going to mingle for a few minutes. And so, breathing in, it's on the left foot. Breathing out, it's on the right foot. Right? And then we just turn it into walking. So as you breathe out onto the right foot, just before you breathe in, move the left foot forward a few inches. And then as you breathe in, move the right foot forward begin the breathing out. And it's very easy. Keep the eyes softly focused so you don't bump into people. But just we'll spend a few minutes just mindfully walking. So maybe 8 more steps. Take your 8 steps and then I guess back to your cushion. Place you are safe. Was that enjoyable? Mm-hmm. It was an enjoyable race with him. Interesting. As I looked at people, a word came to me, a memory of a phrase called authentic presence. What's that in Hebrew? And there was an article years ago by a dancer who talked about mindfulness and dance, and how in dance what you want is this authentic presence, this sense that the person is really there and fully there. And that's, you know, that same is what we want to be with our mindfulness, is to be fully authentically present. And as I was watching people, I realized more so than any time we have done walking meditation here, I just that presence just was bursting out of people. I mean, it was so obvious in the room that people were fully present, which is great. Okay. Hold it closer. Maybe turn it on. Hold it present. Okay. So, yesterday we talked about Vedana, the embodied feelings. And really, the theme, the reason I wanted to bring it up was, you know, and the whole theme of using the 16 exercises, is they're really all ways of moving from separation to connection. That many of us live in an internal space that's a battlefield. We don't really like our bodies and don't appreciate them and are somewhat at war with them. Oftentimes it comes out about food choices, right? I mean, we eat things we don't want to eat. I mean, so that's a battle there. If you're eating things you don't want to eat, there's a battle going on between you and your body. And oftentimes we don't want to face our feelings, our embodied feelings, our root. I mean, as the sutra said, and 2,500 years ago, the Buddha was talking about this in terms of there's something painful, and we turn away from it. And we turn away to a distraction, to a pleasure, or we lament it, and then that becomes a habit, and then it turns into craving because we need that. And it's just so common in subtle ways we're doing that, in my experience. And the Vedana, these embodied feelings, both to modern science and to the Buddha, are always occurring. I mean, they're just so much part of every living moment. And our practice is to calm them down and to be able to turn to them and face them and understand them. Years ago, in an earlier career, I did applied anthropology. And I was working on a study of, he's going to have fun translating this, sex for crack exchanges. So it was a study of people who were using crack cocaine, you know, of powdered of smokable cocaine, crack. And is there a word for it in Hebrew?
Crack.
Right, and this was back in the 90s when it was new. And it was this situation where a lot of women would get into using it and rely on it because it gave them a good high, but then they didn't have money. And most of the dealers were men, and so there was a lot of exchanging sex for crack. And my study was working in 8 cities to understand what was going on and to understand more deeply what were the implications for AIDS transmission. So it was a wild study. We had participant observers in crack houses around the U.S. With special immunity from the police, if and when they got busted, which happened. But the story is, I was talking to a guy in a jail in Los Angeles who had been busted for crack. And I was chatting with them and wanting to get to know him and asked him, why he used crack. And he said, "I'll be honest with you, I use it because I enjoy it." And we talked for a while, and he says, "I really enjoy crack. But if I didn't have crack and I had beer, if I had alcohol, I'd be okay. I could deal with that." So we talked a little bit more about that. And then he said, "If I didn't have beer, if I had television, I could deal with it." So think about that. Crack, beer, and television. What do they have in common? Distraction, turning us away from what's actually going on inside of us. I mean, you know, the internet, television are often a way of not of wanting to be entertained, but not wanting to face what's going on inside of us. It's a form. The crack is a form of smokable cocaine that's very hits you very quickly and very strongly with a rush of a high. So there's an interesting story from Thay that is about this that is quite touching, and I've heard him tell it a couple of times years ago, and I keep looking for it in print because I could swear to myself I read it as well, but I've never found it. So if you know of where it appears in print, tell me. And it occurred when he was a young man, relatively young, in his 30s. And it was the late 1950s. Thich Nhat Hanh became nationally known when he was in his teens as a poet and writer. And was this cutting edge of this movement to modernize monastic education, to not just learn sutras, but to learn literature and science and philosophy and other things as well. And he had created his own Buddhist institute, and he was training monks, and he was working with youth, and he was very happy with that. And then the hierarchy decided that he was I'm not sure what the word is. He was getting his there's a word in English called uppity.
That's done.
What?
That's done.
Yeah. What's the word again?
Uppity. You know, or too big for your britches. What? Somebody give me a better English word.
Proud.
Too proud, arrogant. Too much of a problem. I mean, you know. And so they pulled all the funding, forced him to disband the institute. And at the same time, right around that time, his mother died. And he was very, very attached to his mother. And both of these hit Thay hard. And he lost a lot of energy in his life. But he's so productive that if he's only working at 30% energy, I mean, he's doing a lot. So it took a long time for people to realize that he wasn't the same Thay. Something had happened. Something had changed. So they sent him to doctors and sent him to French doctors in Vietnam. And they diagnosed it as depression. But they weren't quite sure what to do with it. So he'd been invited to Japan for some events, and he went to see specialists there, psychiatric specialists, to be treated for depression. And they talked with him and examined him. And they decided what he needed was electric shock therapy.
How old were you?
In his 30s. And so he took that in and said, that sounds drastic. Maybe I should do what I've been telling people to do all these years and come back to the present moment in a stronger way than I ever have. And he really, so he said, you know, that's where he realized how important it was. Breathing in, I step. Breathing out, I step. 100%. And he returned to himself and to the present moment. And his depression lifted. And, you know, it was, in a sense, like a vedana of the felt emotion. I mean, even, this is my interpretation, he didn't say it exactly this way. He'd been running from his vedana, from his felt feelings, which were so strong, that double sense of loss. And he realized he needed to turn back to it. And so this practice that we do came out of that experience. And I have a friend, who's known Thay for longer than I have and suffers from depressions. And she reminds me that sometimes in a question and answer, and he said it to her, that somebody will raise a question about depression, and he'll start off by saying, yes, I've been bit by that too. Bit by that. Yeah, I've been bit by that. So this is important stuff, right? Yes, question? No. All right. Have sabata. So back to the 16. And the third category is citta, is mind. It's often translated, or better translated, as heart-mind. That in the West, we tend to separate our mind from our heart. It's two different organs. We point here and we point here. And in India and Asia, they just point here, our heart-mind. It's where both are. And so the mind is what thinks, what emotes, what judges, what knows. That's all part of the mind. And the it's helpful to think of, we're told to be aware of mental processes and mental formations. Helpful to think about what's the attitude of my mind, the orientation, not the details of what I'm thinking at this moment, but what's the flavor, the quality of this organ or this capacity we have. And so the Buddha, when he talks about mind in the Sutra on the Four Foundations, immediately starts with what are called the three poisons, which are greed, anger, and delusion or confusion, or sleepiness, depending how you want to translate it. It's called raga, dosa, and moha. And so greed is this mind. I mean, you know, a greedy mind, a greedy person is always, what's in it for me? What can I get in? I want more of this. That's the greedy mind, always wanting, always thinking of me. And each of these, we can go to the other extreme. So what's the generous mind? Go first. Here's the best piece for you. How can we both grow while we're doing this? That's the generous mind, right? So, but do you get this idea that it's the shape of the mind, which then transfers to a lot of different content? That's often called greed, or passion, or lust, rasa. The second one is dosa, which is hatred, anger, aversion. And it's that real quality of, I don't want that, and especially with hatred, of I want harm to come to you. I am so upset with you. So that's the mind. And we know that one. And we know, you know, racism. And we know homophobia. We know, and there's so many times that people, their mind shifts into this rage towards other people. And the opposite of that is this, you know, embracing of difference, of loving kindness. And then the third one is moha. It's on one end sleepiness, confusion, delusion, and the other side is alert, clarity, awake, understanding. Delusion. Misunderstanding.
Delusions are shleya.
Misunderstanding. Delusion. Seeing, believing things that aren't true, making up things. Anyway. So those are the first three in the sutra. And then it goes, well, we'll catch it in the 16 trainings in a minute, but in the Sutra of the Four Foundation, it goes on to talk about concentrating the mind, about being able to better notice subtleties, subtle things, being able to achieve higher states, which are all things important for people in the practice. So let's go to the 16 trainings, if you have your chart, and I'll read them to you if you don't. So exercise 9 in this third section. Breathing in, I'm aware of my mental processes, mental formations, attitude, orientation, whatever word works for you. Breathing out, I'm aware of my mental processes, mental formation, attitude, orientation. So as a practice, I mean, it's, and we most, you know, as we're sitting, it's breathing in, and rather than being caught up in where my mind is taking me in terms of the details, what I want, like I'm thinking about, oh, my computer is 5 years old, it's time for a new computer. I mean, those are the details of the story. But the larger context is wanting, desiring. Right now, my mind is in a desiring mode. What I have is not enough, and my mind is wanting something. That's the underlying attitude. So we just say, oh, okay, that's what's going on now. And then a bit later, I settle down, and there's a sense of ease in my, you know, and I just notice that all of a sudden things are coming easier. So I notice ease in my mind as a mental formation. And maybe, you know, and there are lists of these, and there's, problem is there are many lists of the different types of mental formations. But it might be something like shame, or it might be loyalty, it might be connection with ancestors. I mean, so it varies. So the first thing is just to notice our mind working. Notice how it's working, what it's attracted to. Somewhat clear? And these are, these, again, we've moved into primarily thinking, thoughts, and orientation. And so these are easier to catch, and also easier to get caught by. But the second one is breathing in, I gladden my mind. Breathing out, I gladden my mind. Gladden is to make happy, to experience increasing delight. So the idea is that at this level, it's somewhat easier than with our felt emotions to actually control what's going on in our mind. We can turn our mind to various things, and we want to gain the strength of experiencing things that nourish us and make us happy, in order to have the strength to look at the things that are difficult. So how do we do this? How do we gladden our mind? Too many pages here. So one way that I like a lot is a gratitude practice. When I'm at home, I often journal in the morning. And I start with 5 things I'm grateful for. And when you stop and do that, and people who teach gratitude practice, it changes you, because you're giving your attention to that which supports you. And it could be a lousy day in other ways, but you had a good cup of tea. So you write that down. Or you're saying, you know, it's a lousy day, but my partner's still with me. So you write that down. Or whatever it is that's positive, I mean, you know, that you're grateful for. You're grateful for the practice. I mean, so that's one way of doing it. People also, clarity and concentration is a way of gladdening the mind. There was a book written years ago by a psychologist with a difficult name. His name is Csikszentmihalyi, a Hungarian, and the book was Flow, and a lot of people read it. And that's what he was saying. So there are times in life when we're doing something that's difficult, but not too difficult, so we're competent at it, and it's a full body experience, and we experience flow, the sense of things are just coming together, and it's a joyful feeling. People get it, and it's the reason people ski, or sail, or, you know, play tennis. I mean, you get into the mind-body experience, and there's a lightness that arises from it. So we can do that in meditation. I mean, if we're concentrated and clear, I mean, the meditation itself lightens us. And what Csikszentmihalyi was saying, flow comes to these special moments in life. And what Thay says is every moment can be flow. So at the start I said, a quote from Thay, mindfulness is the celebration of life in the present moment. And so if we can learn to celebrate life, if we can learn to look at the tree and just be with the tree and its exuberance, I mean, that gladdens the mind. Other ways are looking at the good seeds we have in us, that from our ancestors, from our parents, there's many good qualities of loyalty, perseverance, heartfulness that we got from our parents. And so just to appreciate that. And we cultivate this happy mind in order to be stronger so we can work with the difficult parts. Okay? Clear? Clear enough? We're moving through quicker than yesterday. Where's my watch? Okay, the exercise 11. Breathing in, I concentrate my mind. Breathing out, I concentrate my mind. To concentrate, compose, collect, steady the mind. So, there's a word Thay uses a lot called bodhicitta, which is the mind of love, which is the mind moving towards awakening. So that's an orientation of the mind. There's also samadhicitta, the mind that's concentrated, which has a certain shape and flavor. And it's the mind that is firm, steady, undistracted, focused on a single object. So it's easy to get distracted. We're used to that. So we develop this quality through practice, through coming back, of being able to stay with an object of mind so we can understand it more deeply. So we really get to know it, really get to know what it feels like, and also see the slight variations, the nuances, so we understand better where it came from and what its consequences are. That has to do with concentration. And the fourth one is, the fourth in this section, breathing in, I liberate my mind. Breathing out, I liberate the mind. Liberating, releasing, letting loose. And the way Thich Nhat Hanh explains it, he uses that metaphor, which we talked about a day or two ago, about untying our knots. I mean, there are things that close us off from ourselves and other people. Sorrows, anxieties, worries, irritation, fear, doubt, and especially the sense of I, me, and mind as separate from other people are things that disconnect us. And so to liberate the mind means to let go of those things, let go of what are called unwholesome mental formations, difficult mental formations. Unwholesome in the sense that it's like it's a nourishment of food. We can eat unwholesome food or wholesome food when we eat. We can eat potato chips or we can eat carrots, right? And especially the Mahayana tradition says what we keep in our mind are like carrots or potato chips. You can spend your day eating potato chips or you can eat a balanced diet, right? So that's what we're, the intent of the 12th, step 12. But let me talk about how we do it. And maybe a bell. We do it with bells. So it's a mnemonic device to remember, and it's two words. Ra, who's the Egyptian sun god, right? Ra. And Eliot, who's sitting over there, but also is an Old Testament prophet, right? So we got these two words. Ra, Eliot, or Eli. So the first R is for recognize. The first step in untying our knots, or even in working with our difficult embodied feelings, is to notice them. If we can't notice them, if we can't experience them, we can't do much. Right? It's like the alcoholic who doesn't want to admit he or she is an alcoholic. There's not much you can do because there's no recognition and therefore no, you can't work with it yet. So we have to be able to see it, to see, hello greed, hello anger, hello anxiety, hello fear. And I found over the years, we each have our own sort of demon or energy that we work with that's problematic. And I tell people in my own experiences, we need to get a PhD in that specific root issue that we have. Anger, fear, anxiety, withholding, whatever it is. And we really need to know it. So first is recognize. Clear? A is for accept. And it simply means really acknowledging that this is what I have and often have. And it's there. Accept doesn't mean condone. It's not that we'd like it necessarily, but it's what we got. And so we have to work with it. It's what our parents gave us, our society gave us, our ancestors gave us, our schooling gave us, our watching 47,000 movies gave us. I mean, we have at this moment certain attitudes, orientation, mind states, and just accept that. What's helpful for me is that accepting doesn't mean that I'm responsible for it. I mean, to really see it as arising from this multitude of causes and conditions, but it's what I've got now. I've got to deal with my anxiety, even though it wasn't like I was born without any anxiety and it's all my fault that I have it now. It, a lot of people contributed, but it's mine to deal with now. E stands for embrace, and it's really something quite wonderful about Thay's teaching, is that we can go at this very analytically. All right, it's fear. And okay, I get it, I've got that. And embrace, you know, there's a warmth to embrace. What's the word for embrace? Embrace. It's like your child comes running to you a little afraid, and what do? Right? You embrace them. I mean, and so our anger, our fear, our anxiety is finally getting to talk. We've spent years, decades, not recognizing and not accepting it. And now it's starting to talk, and so we embrace it. Hello. Hello, fear, my old friend. Hello, dear one. You know, let me cuddle you for a little bit so you'll calm down. Is that clear? It's a really lovely way to do it. So the L is looking deeply. So after we've recognized it, accepted it, embraced it, we sit with it. We live with it. If it's a long-standing issue, I mean, that we've been angry for years, or fearful for years, or sad for years, it's rarely snap, you know, okay, I've got it. It's repeatedly coming back to it and looking into it. This is the getting the PhD part. And understanding what nourishes it. When does it arise strongly? What happens that leads it to manifest? And what are the consequences? What does it mean? And so over time, it becomes less fearful, but we begin to understand how this works. And how not to do the things that lead it to arise often. And we also, by understanding what it does, I mean, that gives us more energy not to do the things that lead it to arise, or not to allow other people to do the things that cause it to arise. And that slowly, as it gets embraced, and as we reduce the causes and conditions that lead to it, it becomes less powerful. So the I in Ellie stands for insight, understanding. I mean, we get it. We have that moment that says, Now I understand the other person's anger. I contributed to the other person's anger by not being understanding or distant, and eventually they got angry at me. And I could have said something, done something sooner, and avoided this whole thing. And then we get an insight. The reason this boss, my boss, in other words, right, boss? Yeah. The reason my boss disturbs me so much, he has the same tone as my father. When I was a teenager and my father was hard on me and said I couldn't do anything right, my boss reminds me of him, and that's why I get so upset with him. And he's not my father, so maybe I can back off this. Or whatever. I mean, it deepens and grows. So my experience with this, I have moods that come to me that I don't quite understand. That I get sad or I get fearful. I often get anxious. And so what I'll do is go sit. And I'll go through a calming exercise like we've been doing. And then I'll turn to it and say, okay, hello anxiety. Or more likely I'll say, what is going on now? What is it? And I'll just sit with it for a while and feel it. And one of the things I do is say to myself, where do I feel? Is it in my heart? Is it in my stomach? Is it in my head? Is it everywhere? And what's the flavor? What's particular about this moment of sadness or fear? So I get to know it. And then I start asking it questions when we talk. And so, right, when have I felt this way before? Does this particular flavor of fear, are there other times I have had it? Probably yes. What preceded this? Is there something that triggered this? And so this may take 20 minutes, 30 minutes, perhaps longer. And then what I do, and this, some people love this, some people, it's not their way. I get up and my handwriting is so bad I have a hard time reading it. Since the seventh grade, I do everything on, well, first it was typewriters and then it was computers. So I go to my computer and I start writing and I do something called free writing. People know it?
Yeah.
People don't know it too, but it's good to know. So the way I do it is I start off and I put at the top of the page what seems to be going on is. And I start writing. And the rule is you write whatever comes into your head. Absolutely no censor. You leave nothing out. And if nothing's in your head, you write down nothing is in my head. Right? And you just keep writing. And oftentimes it's coming so fast it's hard to keep up. But you just allow yourself, in a sense, to do a brain dump of what is going on right now? What is this feeling about? And some of the things that I touched in the meditation will come up, but new things will come up. It's, you know, one memory leads to another, and, well, this is about my father, but it's also about so-and-so, and the difficulties of finishing my PhD, and whatever. You know, things just start rolling along. And so you just let it roll, usually 10 or 15 minutes. Just let it roll. And then I stop and I draw a line and I say, write down, what I seem to be saying is. So I try and start bringing it together. So I go back and read over what I wrote and I notice themes and you know, patterns. And so I start writing those down. this is all about challenges, or this is about not being appreciated, or this is about feeling lonely. And I just start writing on that and sort of, what is this really about? And sometimes I do it another way. And for me, often what happens by the time I'm done, I've well, two things happen. One is the strength of that emotion or mind state has lessened, and I've understood it better. It has to do with I didn't get enough sleep, and I started off poorly. It's, you know, with children often, how we see more clearly how one thing causes another, that they're not, have no idea the two are connected. When my son was young, he used to get ear infections, and I would diagnose him over breakfast without looking at his ear. I mean, he had a certain tone, a certain whine that he only had when he had an ear infection. And so when he got that tone, we went to see the doctor. And 80, 90% of the time, she said, yes, he has an ear infection. And he had no connection between, you know, in his mind, why he was upset that their breakfast wasn't what he wanted, had no relation to the issue that that there was something medically wrong with him, that he hadn't yet felt the ear infection. He wasn't saying my ear hurt. And it's the same with us. Sometimes we can trace this out. One of the things I traced out over the years, and years ago I was in therapy, and often, you know, I would be sad, you know, just fatigued and sad, and so we would talk about all these things in my life. And then years later I realized, I started putting it together, that it always happened. I would do this every fall. And every spring, I would start going through these sad periods. And I learned that I had an allergy. I was allergic to ragweed in the fall and pollens in the spring. And my reaction to them was not, like most people, to get a stuffy nose, is what the doctors call a constitutional reaction. Mm-hmm. So my reaction was to get fatigued and sad and whatnot. And talking to therapists, they let, you know, let's talk about your mother, let's talk about what you're not allowing in, and which, you know, there were interesting things that came out of that. But once I realized it was due to the allergies, then it was, well, one, it made it more in my control, and I understood it. And two, I got allergy shots, I learned how to be more allergy free, and to recognize the symptoms earlier. How are we doing on time, sister? Give me a bell.
5 minutes.
Oh. You're a great audience, do you know that? I'm really enjoying looking out at you and feeling supported. So what I had planned to do, I'll tell you about what we want to do, it was a metta meditation where we send loving kindness, which is another way of doing gratitude and of gladdening our mind, opening our mind. But there was part of it I needed to explain. And so I'll give you just the explanation as a food for thought before lunch. So yesterday was it I talked about unconditional love and forgiveness? Mm-hmm. And there's one part I forgot to say, is that unconditional love and forgiveness does not mean that we forget what the person did. That if it was somebody who was a drunk driver who killed somebody, it doesn't mean, okay, go back to your life. I mean, we have laws against that, and that person needs to. Usually that person is put in away from other people for a while to try and help them understand the severity of what they had done, and hopefully getting some rehabilitation while they're there. Maybe joining Alcoholics Anonymous while you're in prison. So it doesn't mean we don't take precautions. If somebody has hurt people, hurt children, it doesn't mean, okay, we forgive you, we're going to let you back play with children again right away. I mean, there's a protectiveness to it. What it means is, I forgive you in the sense that I let go of this anger in my heart. And I recognize that there were causes and conditions that led you to do what you're doing. And there was probably a lot of suffering in your life, in your early life. What they find is that most child abusers were abused when they were young. I mean, there's a way things carry on. So I can understand that, have compassion for them. It's like Ty in the poem, Please Call Me By My True Name, developed compassion for the pirates from Thailand who were raping and stealing from the Vietnamese boat refugees. It doesn't mean he wouldn't want to protect the refugees from them. I mean, he wants to protect them and actually was out there trying to protect them. But he wants to give up his anger towards them. He wants to replace it with compassion, but it's a firm compassion. It's not a weakness. It's you're still allowed to act strongly and forcefully when you need to. Thich Nhat Hanh says the same thing about the protective use of force. He's not a pacifist in saying, you know, you don't oppose anyone anytime. That there are times you need to have a clear line. And so in the, I can post it afterwards. In the metta meditation I was going to use was one I like a lot because it has a realism to it. And I'll say it, first I'll tell you what it is using myself. So it goes, may I be well, happy, and peaceful. May no difficulties come to me. May no problems come to me. May I always meet with success. And may I also have the patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. It's a very practical mental meditation. And we were going to go through and doing that with loved ones and doing it with ourselves, doing it with family and friends, associates, and I was had in it, which is traditional, doing it, saying it to the people who have harmed us or may intend to harm us. And it's done with this understanding, which I wanted to explain before doing it, which is the same thing, that people who hurt other people are doing it from a real sense, often a sense of loss, sense of disconnection, sense of hurt. And so in wishing them well, I mean, it's one asking them to be well, happy, and peaceful. May no difficulties come to you. May no problems come to you. May you always meet success. It's not wishing them success to complete their hateful actions, but it's saying, if you could experience that, you would lose your hate. You wouldn't have that hate. And so rather than doing things that make you hate me more, I'm trying, at least in my intention, to send you goodwill so that you will hate everyone less, be kinder to your children, kinder to your partner. And so that's the intention. It's not a simply wishing well to those who harm us, whether they be the, right in front of us who we've had feuds or resentment with for years, or whether on a larger scale, it's people who have harmed us, may wish to harm us, to really see that as how do the actions I take to protect myself not be wise actions? Well, one quick more thing, and then on our side, just about why it's helpful is that physiologically, anger, when it's really controlling us, is called a refractory state, in that it's moving our energy into action, into our hands, into our legs, and it's closing down the possibilities we see. Once we're angry and are really into it, we just want to do what we want to do, and we don't think about other possibilities. And so protecting ourselves out of a place of calm and love is actually more effective. And if you've studied martial arts, and which I dabbled in over the years, I mean, when you do Aikido, and even in things like Taekwondo and Kung Fu, they work at establishing a calm center. That, you know, they're effective, and they know what to do, and they know how to use force protectively, but they realize that if they get angry, they become less skillful. And it just doesn't work as well. And so there's this constant, interesting cultivation of both a martial spirit and a calm, centered, loving core. And during the Middle Ages in Japan, the samurai would come to the Zen temple to learn meditation. And there was often a crossover. The Zen samurai, when they retired, would often become Zen priests. And sometimes martial arts were taught in the dojo, in the meditation hall, because there was this recognition that if you're a sword fighter, losing your concentration in a sword fight is an occupational hazard, right? So we need to be centered and calm and open to possibilities and receptive of what's coming at us. And I think that will close it for this morning. Thank you all very much. What was the word?
Occupational hazard.
Occupational hazard. Apologies for my not always using simplified English. I forget about how some of these terms are not commonly used in the world. And so.
It's not because of you. We don't know English that well. Not everybody knows English.